Our newspaper coverage on the Talking Information Center continues on this Tuesday, the 18th of August, 2026. With the Boston Globe, we say hello to Pete.
Good morning, everybody, and thank you for listening and tuning in to the Talking Information Center. From the front page of today's Globe, prosecutors assert Clancy was in control. As the Lindsay Clancy murder trial enters its fourth week of testimony, the prosecution and defense agree that she strangled her three children. It's her state of mind during the killings that's being contested. Prosecutors, who rested their case Monday after calling 71 witnesses, have insisted that she was in control and brought forth psychiatric providers who said Clancy didn't show signs of postpartum psychosis. They also called on Patrick Clancy, her then-husband, who described Lindsay Clancy as having one of her best days on the day of the killings, even amid a stretch of deteriorating mental health. However, opinions from legal experts the Boston Globe interviewed vary whether the prosecution had been successful in making its case to the jury. Clancy's defense attorney, Kevin Reddington, contends that she was in the throes of a psychotic break on January 24, 2023, and under the command of a voice who told her to kill her children. During his cross-examination of prosecution witnesses, Reddington has previewed the case he'd been planning to mount. He asserted Clancy was over-medicated and misdiagnosed by psychiatric providers who failed to consult each other about their treatments and missed signs of an impending psychotic break. On Monday, he called his first set of witnesses, including Lindsay Clancy's mother, Paula Musgrove, who described her daughter as a dedicated and fun mother. 3 months before the killings, Musgrove said, Clancy texted her in a cry for help. Medication that she'd been taking for postpartum mental illness wasn't working, she said. I'm really sick. Something is wrong, Lindsay Clancy wrote to her mom. Attorney Joseph Perullo, who has represented clients who used insanity defenses, said Saturday that the real trial begins when the prosecution rests, which it did Monday morning. This part of the trial, both sides are using the bare facts of the case to highlight and preview what the experts are going to say in their mental health defense and prosecution, Perullo said. Prosecutors, he said, hoped to convince the jury that despite her repeated efforts to get psychiatric care, Clancy's mental health struggles didn't reflect psychosis, but instead a personality disorder that does not excuse her from criminal responsibility. In rebuttal, Reddington is arguing Clancy's mental state collapsed along the uneven path of psychological deterioration, Perullo said. There's not a straight line, he said. You go up and down, up and down, up and down, but the trajectory overall is in line that's going towards a psychotic break. Prosecutors have called witnesses who described Clancy, 36, as behaving rationally on the day of the killings. They recounted Clancy playing in the snow with her children and taking her daughter to a doctor's appointment before sending Patrick Clancy out of the house to pick up medication and a takeout order. This is paramount to the prosecution's case, that this is not a psychotic break, but a deliberated act of premeditated murder, said Margaret McLean, a former prosecutor and Boston College professor who has been tracking the trial on her True Crime YouTube show. Attorney Keith Halpern, who has also handled insanity defenses, said the prosecution so far hasn't offered evidence to support its contention that Clancy was unhappy with her life. Prosecutors allege she wanted to kill herself and take the children with her because she didn't trust anyone else to care for them. Halpern said the prosecution witnesses have consistently testified about Clancy's love for her family and her work as a nurse. Nobody has ever heard her say a word to suggest that she was unhappy with her life, he said. She was unhappy that her life was being taken from her by a mental illness that she couldn't stop. Prosecutors have sought to support this theory by pairing digital evidence about Clancy calculating the drive time from her husband's errands on Apple Maps with testimony from medical examiners about how long it would take to strangle each child. Clancy has admitted to killing her children, Cora, 5, Dawson, 3, and Kaylin, 8 months. Afterwards, Clancy cut her own wrists and throat and jumped from a second-story window in what her defense has described as a suicide attempt. Clancy's injuries from the jump paralyzed her, and she uses a wheelchair now. She has pleaded not guilty to 3 counts of first-degree murder, asserting an insanity defense based on claims she was suffering from postpartum psychosis and bipolar disorder that had gone undiagnosed. Testimony review resumes on Tuesday in Plymouth Superior Court. Reddington's cross-examination of the psychiatric providers who treated Clancy before the killings is aimed at giving the jury somebody else to blame, said Chris Dearborn, a Suffolk University law school professor who runs a criminal defense clinic. His argument is they dropped the ball, and because of that, she was not clinically responsible at the time of the incident, Dearborn said. In something with such a horrific set of facts, I really think it's an important piece of the case is to give the jury somebody else they can feel okay about blaming other than Lindsay Clancy. 2 psychiatrists and 2 certified psychiatric nurse practitioners have testified about medications they prescribed to Clancy to address her complaints about anxiety, insomnia, and depression following the birth of her 3rd child, Kaylin, in 2022. Reddington's cross-examinations have revealed the psychiatric providers Clancy consulted during that period didn't review records from her other providers and lacked a complete picture of her condition. In one instance, Reddington said, a hospital turned Clancy away from a postpartum psychiatric program over concerns she'd been over-medicated. That hospital couldn't reach one of Clancy's prescribers for further information, he said. The 2 psychiatrists testified that they weren't aware of calls Clancy made to suicide hotlines. In an exchange with one of the psychiatrists, Reddington challenged a note she made about Clancy. In the record, Dr. Jennifer Tufts wrote Clancy was not hyper, pressured speech. Tuft testified the entry meant Clancy did not exhibit pressured speech or speaking faster than normal. Reddington suggested the note recorded the opposite. Your interpretation is incorrect, Tuft said. As opposed to yours, Reddington asked. Jason Benzaken, a defense attorney in Brockton, said cross-examinations like that help Clancy's case by letting jurors decide for themselves whether what psychiatric providers documented about her supported their conclusions. A lot of the witnesses want to offer their overall conclusions rather than the specific observations they made at the time, he said. By delving into these details, Reddington gives jurors a chance to look back and reassess the correctness of their decision-making, Benzaken said. And this next story, again from the front page of today's Globe. Lawmaker contradicts DHS on ICE death. He says the intended target was the victim's roommate, who did not have key removal order. The man ICE agents appeared to be targeting when an officer fatally shot Johann Sebastian Duran Guerrero here last month did not have a final removal order, U.S. Representative Shelley Pingree said Monday, contradicting the Department of Homeland Security's account of the operation. The apparent target was Duran Guerrero's roommate, who owned the car Duran Guerrero was driving when he was killed. Pingree said during a Democratic congressional hearing in Maine examining the July 13th shooting, she said ICE still has not confirmed who is the target of that operation. In just the past few days, we've learned that ICE's intended target, Johann Sebastian's roommate and the owner of the car he was driving that morning, also did not have a final removal order. She called the new information a clear contradiction to what ICE and DHS have been saying about the operation. The day of the shooting, DHS said ICE had been conducting targeted surveillance on the last known address of an illegal alien with a final order of removal. The agency said a person left the residence in a vehicle and attempted to flee when ICE officers tried to stop him. In the statement Monday, a DHS spokesperson stood by that account but said the department had never identified Duran Guerrero or his roommate as the target. It's clearly stated in our previous comments that ICE was conducting targeted surveillance on the last known address of an illegal alien with a final order of removal, the spokesperson said. We are not going to disclose law enforcement sensitive intelligence and methods. Nowhere do we state that Johann Sebastian Duran Guerrero or his roommate were the target. DHS did not identify who agents were targeting or explain why they attempted to stop the car Duran Guerrero was driving. An ICE spokesperson previously said an officer fired his weapon, striking the driver because he was fearing for public safety. Ben Gideon, an attorney representing Duran Guerrero's family, told the lawmakers that the new information raises a fundamental question about why agents attempted to stop the car at all. If neither Duran Guerrero nor the roommate who owned the car had final removal orders against them, Gideon said, there was no lawful justification for stopping the vehicle in the first place. More than a month after the killing, Gideon said, federal officials still have not publicly identified whom the agents were seeking. Our federal government shot and killed an innocent person, Gideon said. A month later, the government has still refused to tell us who the target of the operation actually was or whether there was even any legitimate purpose of the operation at all that morning. Pingree also said Monday that Duran Guerrero had a pending asylum case and held a valid work permit. He was not the target of the ICE operation, she reiterated, and did not have a final removal order. Sue Roche, executive director of the Immigrant Legal Advocacy Project, said her organization reviewed documents provided by Duran Guerrero's family and confirmed he had a pending asylum case and was authorized to work in the United States. He was following all the rules and going about a normal day when he was suddenly and viciously killed by ICE, Roche said. The new details raise questions about whom ICE intended to apprehend that morning, what information agents were working before carrying out the operation, and why Duran Guerrero encountered armed federal agents as he left for work. Duran Guerrero's parents, Dora Guerrero and Omar Duran Plata, also sat in the hearing on Monday. Duran Plata, in his first public words to a U.S. audience, read from a prepared statement in Spanish, which a community advocate translated to English. We do not know how to go on without you, son, Duran Plata said. We only hope we can find the strength to continue. He described his son as a responsible and loving father who worked hard to support his young family and remain close to his family in Colombia and his sisters. The death of Johann Sebastian under these conditions, at the hands of ICE, fills our community with fear and uncertainty, Duran Plata said. That is why I ask of God and of the justice system that my son's case be brought to light. His words were met with applause from the crowd of about 200 who gathered in the Biddeford High School auditorium. Johann Sebastian Duran Guerrero should be alive today. He should be at home with his partner. He should be watching his 3-year-old daughter grow up. Maine Governor Janet Mills also testified on Monday. She said she would leave the facts of the shooting to an ongoing investigation by Maine Attorney General Aaron Frey's office, but she sharply criticized broader ICE enforcement tactics and said federal operations were creating danger in Maine communities. Like people across Maine, I am heartbroken, I am furious, I am outraged, she said. Mills said Maine communities are not opposed to law enforcement and pointed to the training and accountability standards imposed on state and local police. But she said residents did not want federal agents roaming peaceful neighborhoods or stopping people for non-criminal behavior. Here, members of law enforcement are held to high professional standards, Mills said. She called for ICE agents to be required to wear body cameras, identify themselves, and face civil or criminal liability for abuses of power. If the agency cannot be reined in and fundamentally reformed, then it's time to abolish it, Mills said. The ICE agent who fatally shot Duran Guerrero on July 13th was later identified as David Brulette. For days, Duran Guerrero's blood still stained the streets near the intersection where he was killed. Weeks after Duran Guerrero was killed, federal officials have provided little to no additional information about the shooting. DHS has said the shooting will be investigated and that the DHS Office of Inspector General was notified. Gideon told lawmakers Monday that no one from the Justice Department, the FBI, or DHS had contacted the family about an investigation. Video surveillance from the aftermath of the shooting showed Duran Guerrero's white sedan traveling aimlessly through an intersection. An unmarked SUV then rammed the car, bringing it to a stop, and federal agents pulled Guerrero, who appeared motionless, from the driver's side door. Biddeford Mayor Liam LaFontaine told lawmakers Monday that federal agents left it to the city to face the repercussions of the ICE operations. A federal force came into my city, exercised one of the most extraordinary powers the government possesses, the use of deadly force, and left the consequences for Johann's family and for our city to carry, LaFontaine said. He said Biddeford police, firefighters, schools, public work employees, and community organizations had been left to respond to the fears, protests, and misinformation that followed. The authority was federal, LaFontaine said. The burden has been local. The mayor said they have not heard from any federal agencies or leadership. Duran Guerrero came to the U.S. several years ago from Bucaramanga, a north central Colombian city, and settled in Biddeford with his partner and young daughter, working multiple jobs, cleaning at a veterinary clinic and delivering food, his family said. Brulette has been accused of abuse by two ex-wives, as documented in hundreds of court documents. The women claimed he had violent episodes and a history of mental health struggles. Brulette himself said a severe head injury impaired his cognitive function. Gideon seized on that history, arguing that Brulette's hiring pointed to a broader failure in ICE's screening and training. This is the individual that our government handed a gun and a badge to and put out on the streets to enforce our immigration laws, Gideon said. And this next article is going to be from the Nation section of today's Boston Globe, and it is headlined, Trump's Appeal of the $5 million Carroll payment has been rejected. The Supreme Court, for a second time, refused a request by President Trump to review a $5 million civil judgment against him after a jury found in 2023 that he had sexually abused and defamed writer E. Jean Carroll. The announcement Monday did not include the justice's reasons, which is typical when the court issues routine orders. There were no noted dissents. Trump paid Carroll in July, a few days after the court initially turned away the president's appeal. He also made a long-shot request to the justices that they reconsider, which the court formally declined on Monday. The president has separately asked the Supreme Court to overturn a much larger award of $83.3 million that a jury ordered him to pay in 2024 for defaming Carroll in 2019 after she accused him of a decades-old rape. The justices are on summer recess and not expected to reconsider whether to take up the case until late September at the earliest. The request the justices dispatched on Monday was always a long shot, since they rarely reconsider when asked. Still, it was another series of blows to the president's efforts to contest Carroll's claims and avoid the two separate monetary awards that juries have ordered him to pay related to Carroll's allegations. In a statement, Trump's medical team said, "The American people stand with President Trump as they demand an immediate end to all the witch hunts, including the Democrat-funded travesty of the Carroll hoaxes. President Trump will keep winning against liberal lawfare as he continues to focus on his mission to make America great again." Carroll's lawyer, Roberta Kaplan, said in a statement, "We're pleased that the United States Supreme Court has declined again to hear this case. As a result, the jury's unanimous verdict that Donald Trump sexually assaulted and then defamed E. Jean Carroll is now final and cannot be challenged in any court." The $5 million matter stems from a trial held in May 2023 when a federal jury in New York found the president liable for sexually abusing and defaming Carroll. The jury agreed that Carroll, a former magazine writer, had sufficiently shown that Trump sexually abused her in a dressing room of the Bergdorf Goodman department store when the two crossed paths in the 1990s. Further, the jury found that Trump had defamed Carroll by posting a statement on social media calling her case a complete con job and a hoax and a lie. Throughout, Trump denied Carroll's allegations. After that verdict, Trump appealed to the Second U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals, asserting, among other things, that the trial judge, Louis A. Kaplan, erred by allowing certain evidence to be shown to the jury. In December 2024, a three-judge appeals court panel upheld the jury's verdict, finding that Trump failed to show that the evidence had harmed his rights to a fair trial. Trump then asked the justices to weigh in and find that the jury has erred. And this next article, I believe, is States Take Meta to Trial in Fight Over Social Media Harms. And it links platforms to youth mental health crises. Of the thousands of lawsuits Meta faces over child safety on its platforms, none may be more consequential than one going to trial this week in California. States are seeking extensive financial damages that could, in theory, total as much as 14, I'm sorry, could total in theory as much as $1.4 trillion, plus changes to how the company operates Facebook and Instagram. The lawsuit accuses the social media giant of contributing to the youth mental health crises by knowingly and deliberately designing features that get children addicted to its platforms. It also claims that Meta routinely collects data on children under 13 without their parents' consent in violation of federal law. Meta has harnessed powerful and unprecedented technologies to entice, engage, and ultimately ensnare youth and teens. Its motive is profit, and in seeking to maximize its financial gains, the lawsuit says. Dozens of states filed the lawsuits 3 years ago. The trial, set to begin Tuesday in federal court in Oakland, California, features four of the states as plaintiffs: California, Colorado, Kentucky, and New Jersey. The other 25 states are expected to have trials later. Meta said it disputes the allegations, and the trial evidence will show its commitment to supporting young people. "We've listened to parents, worked with experts and law enforcement, and conducted in-depth research to understand the issues that matter most," the company said in a statement. For Meta, which already lost two pivotal cases over harms to children and teens this year, the stakes are high. The company reported a rare profit decline last month, in part due to $2.4 billion in legal expenses. The $1.4 trillion figure, which Meta disclosed in a legal filing, is almost as high as the Menlo Park, California company entire market capitalization. That is, the value of all its outstanding shares on the stock market. Paying it would inevitably put Meta Platforms in bankruptcy and perhaps put the company under state ownership. The state attorneys general are going for the gusto, said Eric Goldman, a professor and co-director of the High Tech Law Institute at Santa Ana University School of Law. "They are trying to set the definitive precedent in this case, and they have asked for extraordinary damages, and they're going to seek extraordinary structural remedies if they succeed." Meta called the possible penalty untethered to any claimed violation by the states. "A sanction of that size has no analog in the history of consumer protection enforcement," Meta said in a July 6th filing with the U.S. District Court for the Northern District of California. If Meta loses the trial, the court would have wide discretion over the size of any financial penalty, and legal experts say anything close to $1.4 trillion would be unlikely. "It's not plausible in the sense that Meta doesn't have that much money and could not get it," said James Grimmelman, a law professor at Cornell Law School and Cornell Tech. "An award that large would put Meta into bankruptcy, wipe out its owners, and effectively result in the state owning Meta." "As a practical matter," Grimmelman said, "that seems extremely unlikely to happen." In other cases that have involved high potential damages for multiple individual offenses, he said courts have stopped short of imposing the maximum penalties. One example is the Anthropic artificial intelligence training case, where plaintiffs were claiming damages of $150,000 per book that Anthropic copied, but the penalty ended up being $3,000 per book, total about $1.5 billion. The federal trial this week is more complex than the one last year in Los Angeles, where a state court awarded $6 million in damages from Meta and Google's YouTube to a single plaintiff, a young woman who testified that she became addicted to social media as a child. The federal That case was a bellwether or test case picked from thousands of similar tort lawsuits to give both plaintiffs and the defendants an idea of how their arguments would fare in court. The jury determined that Meta and YouTube were negligent in the design or operation of their respective platforms, and that negligence was a substantial factor in causing harm to the plaintiff. They also determined each company knew their platforms could be dangerous when used by a minor, and that they failed to adequately warn of that danger. The Oakland case, meanwhile, has state attorneys general as the plaintiffs and centers on state and federal statutes they allege Meta violated, which lay out potentially large amounts of penalty for each violation. And that's the end of that story. And turning now to the world section of today's Globe. There we go. My computer's a little slow today. Sorry about that. Trump lashes out as Iran deal expires. Threatens ally Oman, which aided peace talks. As a crumbling truce with Iran officially collapsed Monday, President Trump signals his frustration at his inability to resolve a war that he started himself but cannot seem to end. In an interview with Fox News, the president lashed out at a U.S. ally, Oman, which had been trying to mediate negotiations with Iran. If Oman gets in the way, we'll bomb the expletive out of them, Trump said in a phone interview, according to Fox News' Trey Yingst. The latest threat towards Oman, which has facilitated talks between United States and Iran for years and maintains it is still a neutral mediator, came as Trump found himself without much leverage to reach the goals he set out at the start of the war. I think ultimately his threats against Oman are just a reflection of his frustration with the situation he's created where he has no good options, said Nate Swanson of the Atlantic Council's Iran Strategy Project. He's just reflexively lashing out, and at this time, Oman got in the crosshairs. Hostilities have now stretched past the six-month mark in a conflict that began with the United States and Israel launching strikes across Iran in February. Administration officials pledged at the time that the war would be over in 4 to 6 weeks. On the battlefield, the United States has struck thousands of targets in Iran and dealt serious blows to the country's military capabilities. But the president has struggled to achieve the war's political objectives. In June, the two sides agreed to a memorandum of understanding. But that quickly fell apart. Trump and Iran's leaders have said the deal is essentially dead. It is mostly symbolic, but symbols matter, Justin Logan, the director of defense and foreign policy studies at the Cato Institute, said of the expiration of the Memorandum of Understanding. He emphasized that the main function of the agreement was to reopen the Strait of Hormuz, the critical shipping lane in the Persian Gulf that Iran effectively closed. The tragic part here is that the United States is clawing to try to get back to the state of the Middle East before the war started, he said. As the ceasefire officially expires, the president and his team have promised to level crushing sanctions against Iran this week, though the details of those plans have yet to be revealed. And Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth has said the United States can maintain a naval blockade of the Strait of Hormuz indefinitely, an acknowledgement that there was no end to the war in sight. In the Fox News interview, Trump sought to project patience, saying he was, quote, not in a hurry to secure a deal while maintaining that his central goal remains preventing Iran from possessing a nuclear weapon. Speaking to the reporters in the Oval Office, Trump was asked whether he was any closer to ending the war now than he was when the Memorandum of Understanding was agreed to. The president did not directly answer, but claimed that Iran wants to make a deal, but they're not going to make the kind of deal that I feel is necessary. Trump also downplayed concerns that sailors on the aircraft carrier Abraham Lincoln have been deployed for too long with conditions worsening. The ship is supporting U.S. operations in the Middle East against Iran. Trump called the reports of food shortages fake news. And this next article is from the World section of today's Globe. How satellite tech is changing war for Ukrainians. The Russian drone pilots had bedded down for the night. Their white vehicle was parked in the driveway of a small house in occupied southern Ukraine. About 30 miles away, two Ukrainian drone pilots had parked their truck in a tree line at the edge of a field and assembled a medium-sized drone loaded with two bombs. Their target? The sleeping Russian drone pilots. Ukrainian team had a powerful new battlefield tool that night. High-tech satellite imagery providing near real-time information on troop movements and locations. A year ago, it could take days for satellite imagery to get to the frontline troops, slowed by less sophisticated technology and layers of command structure. That made it difficult to hit targets that could move locations, like troops in a house, with long-range drone strikes. Now, a support team monitoring the house provided the drone operators a fresh satellite image showing the car in the driveway, an indication the Russians were there. "The target is confirmed," whispered one of the pilots, who identified himself with the call sign Tiki, in accordance with Ukrainian military policy. The rapid delivery of high-quality satellite imagery to frontline troops is one of the key battlefield advancements of the last year, enabling Ukraine to strike quickly against weapons depots, logistical hubs, and troop encampments deep within territory held by Russians and the Russian itself. The truck used by Tiki and his partners, known by the call sign Teplo, was in fact a mobile command center loaded with computers that connect to commercial satellites. In one new tool developed by Dutch company Bravo One Alpha, images are beamed to a device that looks like a handheld video game console from which pilots can search for targets, plot flight paths, and even fire weapons from drones. Frontline troops in some cases can control satellites themselves, quickly analyzing the image for targets and then firing their weapons. Rapid satellite imagery also helps them verify which targets have been hit and fire again if need be. These advances have underpinned Ukrainians' efforts to isolate the Russian-occupied Crimean Peninsula. Recent satellite-aided strikes have destroyed ferry terminals that Russia needs to supply the peninsula and the logistic routes needed to keep troops fighting in southern Ukraine armed and fed. "This is incredibly helpful," said Mayor Mykolaj Kolesnik, the commander of the regiment. With the war in Ukraine largely mired into a bloody stalemate, progress on the battlefield increasingly comes down to a race for new technologies that can give one side an edge. Drones, whether in the air, on land, or at sea, have emerged as the most effective way to kill or maim enemies. But the technology is less efficient when it comes to finding them. Surveillance drones, known as ISRs, can be shot down or their signals can be jammed. Their ranges are limited, as is the physical area they can cover. Space offers the next frontier. Ukrainians use satellite imagery provided by allied governments and commercial enterprises to aid their fight against Russia even before the invasion of 2022. But until recently, it has been a scarce commodity. And that's the end of that article. And we're now going to page 6, which is back into the nation section of today's Globe. And here we go. Now I got it. According to Trump, vandals damaged grass. The trampled turf is in a spot where the July 4th festivities were located. President Trump said vandals are to blame for large swaths of dead grass on the National Mall near the World War II Memorial, in a spot where he had a stage built and hosted crowds for his July 4th celebration. Trump made the accusation in a social media post Sunday without saying why he believes it's the work of vandals instead of trampled surface from the Independence Day festivities. The Republican president posted a photo showing a once grassy area by the World War II Memorial, now patchy and brown, across much of the sprawling turf. Look what vandals did to the grass connecting the vandalized World War II monument and the vandalized reflecting pool, which will be open again and better than ever shortly, Trump said on his Truth Social platform. Trump has repeatedly blamed vandals for damage to his renovation project in the nation's capital, often without evidence and sometimes despite opposing accounts from his officials. Trump lashed out at U.S. Attorney Jeanine Pirro this month after her office concluded that damage to the Lincoln Memorial reflecting pool was the result of poor construction and not the work of vandals, as Trump claimed. The photo Trump posted matches what you'd expect to see with a large summer event, according to Penn State University turf professor John Kaminsky. Nothing in the photo clearly indicates vandalism. Jumping to that conclusion seems like a fairly large leap, although it is impossible to rule anything in or out, he said. Bradley S. Klein, a freelance journalist and golf course consultant, doesn't sound like a bad job, said the president's post didn't make clear what the problem was in detail. He sounds like every grumpy golfer who's complaining about their golf course and actually has no idea what it takes to maintain it on a day-to-day basis, he said. Messages seeking more information were left with the National Park Service and the Department of the Interior. Authorities Friday announced an arrest in connection with vandalism at the World War II Memorial after the words clean, hands, dirty, and then /body /8217. I'm not exactly sure what that means. You'll have to figure that one out yourself. Were found painted on the monument and bubbles filled a fountain. Pirro said felony charges have been brought against Melissa L. Farris. Farris, 41, of Elizabethtown, Kentucky, remained in custody over the weekend. She is due back for a pretrial hearing September 3rd. A message left with her court-appointed attorney was not returned. Charging documents in that case made no mention of the grassy area Trump is highlighting in his new claims. Authorities said Farris had previously been arrested for camping on federal property, but not the area cited by Trump. That stretch of lawn is instead where a large stage was built and crowds gathered to hear from Trump and watch fireworks at a July 4th event celebrating the nation's 250th anniversary. Trump claimed without providing evidence that more than 400,000 people attended the event. Photos from that time show a large bandstand and seated areas covering nearly the entire lawn, Trump now says, has been vandalized. Associated Press photos from the days that followed showed workers removing the structures, revealing brown, damaged grass underneath. So I guess that's not going to go much further than that. And now we're going to go to the Metro section. And in the Metro section, I'm going to read an article about Head Start. And here we are. The headline is Mass Head Start Advocates. Okay, I'll try that one again. Mass Head Start Advocates Alarmed Over Trump's Deregulation Proposal. Head Start advocates across Massachusetts are sounding the alarm over the Trump administration's plans to upend the early education program for the nation's most vulnerable children. Currently, more than 100 pages of regulations govern Head Start. The administration said earlier this month it wants to roll back federal requirements for the program, including standards on class size, child safety, and health and developmental screenings. Instead, states and cities would have more control over how the program is run. Alongside deregulation, the proposal would add new requirements. Staffers would have to deliver all instructions in English, except in tribal communities that run immersion programs in native languages. There will be a 5% cap on administrative expenses, down from 15%. Following the Trump administration's announcement, Americans have 60 days to weigh in before the proposal goes into effect. The plan also could face legal challenges that might delay implementation. Head Start, established in 1965 as part of President Lyndon B. Johnson's War on Poverty, serves 11,000 children in Massachusetts each year, including those who are homeless, in foster care, or those with disabilities. Massachusetts maintains a robust standard for educator-to-child ratios, education qualifications, and health and safety, according to Amy Kershaw, the state's Commissioner of Early Education and Care. But the new proposal would erode other aspects of Head Start, including nutrition services, mental health and behavioral health, and support for families, she said. Our concern with what is proposed here is that it cuts deeply into the core elements of the Head Start program, which go beyond health and safety and education qualities. The state plans to submit formal comments to the federal government, she said. Michelle Hamowitz, executive director for the Massachusetts Head Start Association, voiced concern that the proposal's language requirement would hinder the learning of students whose native language is not English. This new requirement would erase the This new requirement would erase the culturally appropriate lens of care that Head Start programs have been providing for so long that we know is best for children and families, she said. Head Start should not be viewed as a child care program, but rather as a school readiness program, said Stephen Barnett, founder of the National Institute for Early Education Research at Rutgers University. They're going to destroy the program in terms of its capability to accomplish its key goal, which is school readiness and breaking the cycle of poverty, he said. The problem we have is not that low-income kids can't get cheap childcare. The problem is getting high-quality child development grants that will substantially improve their school readiness and later life successes. Teachers who work directly with Head Start students and families emphasize the importance of several of the regulations that are now under threat, including those mandating student-to-staff ratios and health screening. At a Head Start in Western Massachusetts, run by Community Action Pioneer Valley, Sarah Dunn, a lead teacher, recalled using a child's home language to support their English learning. Dunn sat with the child, holding open a picture book with words in both English and the child's home language. As they flipped through the book, Dunn said the child urged Dunn to pronounce the non-English versions of the words. And when I tried and I made the effort to pronounce it, her eyes absolutely lit up, and you could tell it just sparked a joy for learning, a joy for sharing language, she said. Being able to use her own language was the key to help her learn English. Jody Graham, Community Action Pioneer Valley's Family Services Manager, recounted similar moments. She spoke of a parent who could not find a job without first finding childcare. She remembered a family that discovered their child was almost legally blind through a Head Start vision testing. The program was able to support the family in finding a pediatric eye doctor, she said. That was life-changing for this child, she said. And let's see, where we're going to next. Oops, I overshot. Sorry about that. And this is from the Metro section of today's Globe. In court, ex-Rhode Island fugitive doctor says he can't hire a lawyer. Ronald L. Fisher, the former doctor who spent 21 years evading authority as a fugitive from Rhode Island before he was caught aboard a $1.4 million custom sailboat last month, was referred to the public defender's office Monday after telling a judge he had been unable to hire a private lawyer because his assets were frozen. Appearing before Newport County Superior Court Judge William E. Carnes, Jr., Fisher, 70, said he was still actively seeking an attorney just over a month after his arrest. A handcuffed and unshaven Fisher told the judge in a low voice that he had the funding to hire private legal counsel, but it's a question of access. A judge in the Providence Court froze his assets in connection to the civil lawsuit filed against him last month by Cheryl Gingrich, the woman he was convicted of sexually assaulting decades ago. Carnes referred to Fisher, who faces the possibility of spending the rest of his life in prison, to the public defender's office and gave him until August 24th, one more week, to find an attorney. Fisher's brief appearance in a criminal courtroom was only his second time since his arrest. His inability to secure an attorney underscores the dramatic fall of a former anesthesiologist turned biotech executive who once lived lavishly and owned sailboats, sports cars, and a mansion in East Greenwich, an affluent suburb of Providence. Authorities say Fisher spent years using multiple aliases to conceal his identity, including Dr. Richard Graydon, which Fisher used to pose as a board-certified hematologist-oncologist with a Ph.D. and land jobs in the biotech industry for at least a decade. Fisher has been held without bail since he was taken into custody aboard his 56-foot sailboat, the Silver Lining, in the waters around Manhattan on July 16th. Long considered one of Rhode Island's most wanted fugitives, Fisher has been on the run since he disappeared during his trial for sexual assault charges in 2005. A jury ultimately convicted Fisher in absentia of assaulting Gingrich at a Portsmouth, Rhode Island marina in 2003. Last month, Gingrich filed a civil lawsuit seeking unspecified damage against Fisher, alleging he trapped her aboard his boat and raped her. A Providence County Superior Court judge granted a temporary restraining order in that case, ordering Fisher's assets to be frozen pending a hearing scheduled for Thursday. In court on Monday, wearing khaki pants and a polo shirt, Fisher said he's been meeting with attorneys with the assistance of one who was part of his legal team in 2005, but who since has become a public defender in another country, in another county, sorry. Robert B. Mann, the attorney who represented Fisher during his trial 2 decades ago, died in 2024, according to his obituary. I can refer you to the public defender's office, Karin said. At some point, I'm going to have to move this along. Fisher did not respond when asked for a comment by the Boston Globe reporter as he was escorted outside the house in handcuffs. Gingrich, who granted the Globe permission to use her name, declined to speak with reporters after the hearing, but her son, Jan Hilfer, said his family is a little concerned that Mr. Fisher continues to play games with the judicial system. And that's it for today. Thank you very much for listening. This is Peter, and I read the Boston Globe every Tuesday. I hope you will tune in every Tuesday. My wife, Liza, is not with us today. She's recovering at home, but everything is fine. And thank you for listening. This has been a great opportunity and pleasure for me, and I hope you will continue listening. Thank you, and goodbye.